Welcome to Friends on Film and Other Creative Mischief, brought to you by Friends of River Oaks Theater. I'm your host, Rachel Valentine Acosta, Houston-based filmmaker and programmer.
And I'm Justice Tirapelli Jamail, a writer, filmmaker, and board member of local nonprofit Friends of River Oaks Theater from Houston, Texas.
Every month, we'll bring you engaging interviews with filmmakers, historians, experts, and enthusiasts, and the people who keep art house theaters alive across the globe. Thank you so much for joining us.
First up, a conversation with our friend, Kyle MacLachlan.
Well, actually, okay, shoot. So, as it turns out, the interview with Kyle MacLachlan is going to have to wait. As to the reason for said pause, well, here's the deal. As we record this episode of Friends on Film on Wednesday, August 9th, 2023, the Hollywood writers' strike has officially entered its 100th day. For those of our listeners still unaware, the spark of it all has been the Writers Guild of America's simple hope that issues such as having a raise in compensation, which has up to now left writers living below the poverty line, minimum staffing of writers' rooms and residual payments in the streaming era, and regulation on the use of artificial intelligence, which looms an already put-to-use threat on the jobs of creatives across the industry, could be met and negotiated with the major film studios and their industry executives. Last week, saw a meeting with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, in which the issues brought forth by the WGA were seen largely unmet, and statements littered with disinformation leaked to the press by the AMPTP. As the writers' strike forges on, livelihoods are further seen diminished, art left unflourished, and a future of cinema left uncertain at best, if not frighteningly altered. Not for nothing, but this section was to be filled not with the statement I'm giving, but an exciting interview with one of our favorite living actors, Kyle MacLachlan. Though in order to stay within the boundaries of the strike, the Screen Actors Guild, which valiantly went on strike on July 14th in solidarity with the WGA, has stated there are to be no interviews involving actors discussing future or past projects during its entirety. We wish this episode wasn't an unseasonably short offering, though it should go without saying that we stand in solidarity with the strikes and will do whatever we can to support the WGA and SAG-AFTRA until these needs, human and simple of ass as they are and should be met as, have been agreed to. And to you, our listeners, we ask that you take the time to be and stay informed, to spread the information in whichever ways you can, and to continue to support art created by the guilds, by the people, and for the people, that we may have more golden years of cinema within them to come. While there is no current end in sight for the strikes, we must believe that, like so many of our beloved films, there is a golden light at the end of this tunnel, that good will win before the credits roll.
And now, Cinema House Revival.
Hi, I'm Margot Gerber, and I'm a 25-year veteran of art house theaters, having worked at the American Cinematheque and for Landmark Theaters, as well as distributing art house movies through Vitagraph Films. And our guest today on Cinema House Revival is Russ Collins, who is the executive director of both the State and the Michigan Theaters in Ann Arbor, Michigan, as well as the founder of the Art House Convergence, which he will talk about more, but basically it's an important consortium of art house theaters that support each other. So thank you for joining us, Russ Collins.
Well, it's a pleasure indeed to talk about Art House Revival as what we kind of do here every day, at least just in a historic theater context. So we're very happy about that.
So my first question to get the conversation started, I'd like you to tell the audience a little bit about how you got involved with art house theaters.
Sure. Well, I actually ended up getting a master's degree in theater management. And not too long after I graduated, the job here at the Michigan Theater, which is a 1928 movie palace. And then in 1979, it was taken over by a nonprofit organization called the Michigan Theater Foundation. In 1982, I went to work for them, and I've been here ever since. Now, half a block away from the Michigan Theater is the State Theater, And the State Theater was a 1940s theater designed by C. Howard Crane, who designed many, many theaters around the country. It's an Art Deco cinema-style theater. It was actually turned into a Target store, but the balcony was preserved for cinema space. And in 2017, we remodeled that space and turned it into a four-screen art house. It wasn't a restoration. We have restored the Michigan Theater, but the State Theater, we historically sensitive renovated and put back some of those Art Deco features, but turned it into a four-screen space and even built two screens over the space between where the balcony ended and the proscenium arch of that cinema-style theater went. It was an interesting project, but we currently operate five art house screens. We built a 200-seat cinema next to the Michigan Theater and a performing arts center that also screens cinema, the Michigan Theater. So anyway, I went to school, I got a degree, I got a job, and I never left.
So what keeps you interested? You've been doing this now for over 40 years. What keeps you interested in the art house world?
Well, I have a board of directors that have let me do some interesting things. We started a film festival. We had a really extensive performing arts series in the 1980s and 90s where we did contemporary performance events, new vaudeville, minimalist music, and all kinds of really interesting things that was part of the art zeitgeist of that particular era. Then, as the student film societies collapsed on universities all over, we ended up taking over a lot more of those specialty screenings, art house kind of material. So we got into that part of the business. But we still do a lot of live on stage events and have from the very beginning. But the majority of what we do in terms of product is cinema. The State is 100% cinema. The Michigan is about 75% cinema with about 100 live on stage events a year. And the rest of the year, the screening room has cinema every day. The Michigan Theater itself hosts a couple hundred days of cinema in addition to the live on stage shows. We're also the home of the Ann Arbor Film Festival, which is kind of a remnant of that student film society zeitgeist of the 1960s. We're very, very proud that they make the Michigan and the State and our screening room their home. It is always an exciting time. The Ann Arbor Film Festival is probably the largest experimental film festival in the world, or it certainly is one of them. And that's a very proud thing to host.
In terms of the film that you show, you do a little bit of a hybrid between commercial new releases and revival, or is it all repertory? What's the breakdown?
We want to show award-worthy films. That's kind of our curatorial mantra. And as we know, there are many award-winning commercial films that come out. So, for example, we did show Barbie, which Greta Gerwig directed. She's an art house director and directed many kind of art house films. And Oppenheimer, which is one of those films that has gone over really well, a university town. Christopher Nolan obviously loves art houses and has supported art houses, so we like to support him. We do a lot of repertory. This summer, we're doing a repertory screening every day of various kind of series that we're showing. And we do the typical first-run art house piece. Most of our first-run is art house cinema, documentaries, foreign language film, independent American film, then quite a bit of repertory. And the repertory has definitely picked up in the post-COVID era, which is interesting and exciting. The first run stuff, it's interesting because when we started programming films back in the 80s, it was all repertory. VCRs started to take over. Repertory became a little less vital. And then we did second run films. So we would take, again, some of the award worthy films that had played commercial theaters and bring them back onto campus and play them. We're right in the middle of the University of Michigan campus. We're not actually a part of the University of Michigan. We're an independent nonprofit cinema and historic theater. Then the Indiewood era came in the late 80s and 90s and early O's. That was a very exciting time when there were a lot of great first-run films that mostly weren't playing in a lot of commercial theaters. And towards the end of that era, they were playing in commercial theaters, which was an interesting kind of a competitive dynamic. That was one of the encouragements or economic necessities, depending on how you look at it. When commercial theater started, quote, stealing, I'm putting the quotes on there, unquote, the art house product, then we started showing some of the commercial product that we thought was of higher quality or had won awards in international film festivals before they were released in the United States. That's the general kind of curatorial thing, which is always changing just little by little. It's crazy making. I'm sure any theater manager programmer can tell you that what you did 2 years ago is probably going to be different than what you're doing now, subtly, but what you did 10 years ago is significantly different from what you're doing now.
Are there a few repertory titles that have done really well in the past, like 6 months or year?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they're the same all over. For whatever reason, The Room does a lot of business. I still don't quite understand. The Rocky Horror Picture Show is always huge, huge, huge. We actually sell that show out. But we have quite a few shows that do 100, 200, 300, 400 people. A lot of the anime titles, Japanese animation films, will do 300 or 400 people. Sometimes we can get a sponsor that will essentially give us a decent amount of money and we make it a family screening and show it in English and have 400 or 500 people there. That's not really box office because it's already been paid for, but those are doing pretty well. Wes Anderson seems to do really well in retrospect. Casablanca used to be a winner all the time, and it does pretty well, but it's not that great. Holiday films, of course, classic Hollywood films or classic commercial titles. When you say classic Hollywood, I think people really think of the 30s and 40s, but at this point, the 80s and 90s are classic as much as the 30s and 40s are. Anyway, it's a very interesting dynamic, challenging dynamic. It's just like any other business, though. You have to pay attention to what went before and learn from that and continue it as best you can, but also respond to the now.
So a lot of theaters have been getting involved in eventizing films. Have your programmers entered into any of that beyond like the Rocky Horror or The Room, which brings its own interactive program with it?
Oh, yes. Because we were a silent movie theater, we do a lot of silent films, and we have several organists that are excellent at providing the live musical accompaniment. We will not show a silent film at the Michigan Theater unless it has live musical accompaniment. A few years ago, we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars restoring our organ, putting it in really tip-top shape. And so we're very proud of that instrument and have very talented players that are able to play it. So that's something that we do. When we did Asteroid City on the Thursday night that it opened in Middle America, we pretended like we were the only theater that was showing it. We did a red carpet screening where we literally just put a red carpeting out front, charged regular movie prices, but we ended up with 1,200 people that came to that particular screening. In a very Wes Anderson kind of external dynamic, in the middle of the film, the fire alarm went off, which at first people just sat there and go, is this part of the movie or what? But it was just a popcorn machine that had generated a little extra smoke. So we got everyone back in their seats and went on. It was memorable because people got to see Asteroid City for the first time in a huge audience. It's just so much better to see a comedy when there's a lot of people there. It just makes it a lot more fun. And then the fire alarm going off. For most people, it was a positive memory. There's lots of things like that. We work with local businesses. We've got the Cat Video Festival coming up and eventizing that with the Humane Society and other kinds of veterinary clinics and things like that. The Japanese anime films, those are very easy to eventize with the characters. And doing a lot of performing arts events, we're used to eventizing things. It's something that is, we don't do it every day. Otherwise, it's not eventizing. It's just what you do every day. But we have a lot of tools to be able to do that. And at the Michigan Theater in the 1,600-seat movie palace, most days of the week that we show films, we do have the organ playing, which kind of eventizes any screening and makes it fun and unique. Except because it's played so frequently, I think a lot of our audiences are like, oh, okay, the organ's on. Yeah, they must do this in all big old movie theaters.
They don't know how lucky they are. The fact that you have these historic theaters, is that one of the draws for people to come? Are they aware of the historic nature? And does that play into sort of your marketing?
It certainly is true in terms of philanthropic support. People understand that the spaces are important to preserve. And over the years, I've come to believe that we are more about community than we are about any kind of specific art form or even the buildings. The community gathers in cinemas and theater spaces and public spaces of all kinds. We have donors who hardly ever come to the movies, but they still donate because they like the idea that this old movie theater has been preserved and can be experienced, you know, year after year for many generations in the past and in the future. Being able to show the range of things that we do, both live on stage and in cinema, provides access points for, you want to say, everybody in the community. But of course, we know that that isn't true. And not everybody's going to come out to any particular organization or play any particular sport. But you try to provide a range of things that will engage the community quite broadly. And it really is that community zeitgeist, that community energy that feeds what we do. Now, we're lucky in Ann Arbor that we're in a university town. So the number one criterion for people who are interested in the arts is their level of education. And obviously, a university town has a lot of people with a lot of education, many of them driving taxis and serving coffee and things like that. But that's definitely a good point. And then we have this legacy of music, Iggy Pop and Bob Seger from this town.
I remember hearing you speak at the Art House Convergence many, many years ago. There was a conversation at the time that in order to support showing movies in cinemas, there was going to have to be something that kind of helped with the economics of that. So when you rent for live events, is that helping to enable you to show cinema since those are higher ticket prices and possibly can sell concerts out and things like that?
The strict economic analysis of that is no. We lose money on everything we do. And the reason that we lose money on live shows is that we're in a university town where the university heavily subsidizes all the other venues. It's local donations, community philanthropy, that really is the difference maker in terms of our ability to have these really wonderful facilities and the ability to do the range of programming that we do. We had folks that donated money to restore the organ. We need donations to do the silent films that we do, and we have a consistent donation for that. We have a donation to support the organist because there's no money in hiring an organist and having them play. It really is that philanthropy that makes a difference. When I started, we only raised about 15% of our budget from donations and memberships. In this post-COVID era, it's tending more towards the 45 to 50%. Now, for many years, we were at the 35 to 40% of our total gross budget being donations. And donations are more profitable in terms of there isn't as much cost connected to them as there are to renting the theater where you have stagehands and all that kind of stuff, or showing a movie where you're paying half or a little more than half of the movie revenue to the distributors to both ship you the print and then for the royalties on a print on average. And that's in addition to paying your staff and all of those other things. Philanthropy is the difference maker, but it is the story of cultural organizations for arts organizations. Broadway has many nicknames, Broadway being one of them, but the nickname that people know the best is probably the Great White Way because of all the lights. But one of the other names that isn't as well known is the Fabulous Invalid. What they mean by that is Broadway, for many decades at this point, has always been sick, but it never dies. And essentially, that's what the art house film world is like. It's always just hanging in there. people struggling, doing the best they can. No one's making a fortune on it, but there's a lot of passion, both from the audience and from the operators. If you get good at fundraising and the tools that you need and the skills that are necessary to be successful at that, you can run an art house pretty much anywhere in the country. And obviously, the scale of the art house is going to depend on the scale of the population and the community you're in, the passion of the community that you're in. But you should be able to run an art house, a passionate person who knows to invest their energy, their time, their enthusiasm, and their knowledge about fundraising, as well as their knowledge about cinema in the organization. It can be made a success. This is usually not what people want to hear. They want to hear that if they only price their popcorn at this level or sell more of that in terms of the concession stand, that they'll make it. But really, the best thing that you can do is count on your community to support you. We typically take in about $800,000 a year in membership revenue. In addition to that, we get State Arts Council money. We've gotten a little bit of National Endowment money, but really it's your local people. It's the folks that send in $10, $100, $1,000, $10,000, $100,000. When you do a capital campaign, maybe $1 million or more to support what it is that you're doing, because your passion bleeds to them and their passion responds with the philanthropic support. A cinema organization that's dedicated curatorially to doing the best cinema there is and providing a bit of a perspective on the role of cinema in society is going to be something that people are willing to support, especially if it's in an old, interesting, historic building that has its own particular character. It doesn't particularly need to be an old movie palace. So there's a lot of headwinds that are blowing in the art house world, but they're blowing in all kinds of worlds, and we just have to adapt to them as best we can. I also want to talk about, just for a minute, the art house convergence. So,
I was just going to ask you.
So the art house convergence actually came out of an initiative that Sundance put together in 2006. They ended up inviting about 14 theaters, and I think 12 of them came. The Michigan Theater happened to be one of them. We were very proud about that. And we got together with these colleagues across the country, and we just had a really wonderful time, and people shared. Sundance asked us back, several of us kind of badgered them to ask us back in 2007, which they did. And then in 2008, we convened independently as the Art House Convergence. There were just over 20 people that came to the first Art House Convergence, which was actually in Salt Lake City. Sundance is in Park City, just down the road. The second year, we had 75 people. So we basically tripled the number of people that came, but it was still a small group. It just grew and grew and grew, and it grew organically. It wasn't any kind of marketing genius. It was just people talking to people who were having the same kind of experience with their art house. This thing just kept growing. And at our last Art House Convergence in 2020, there were about 750 people that were at this conference. There was a huge disruption as part of the pandemic. There had been a lot of societal issues that needed to be dealt with. And I actually stepped aside. The idea was always to make the Art House Convergence an independent organization, but there was an urgency to making it an independent organization. So I stepped aside. My organization, which had been the host organization for the Art House Convergence, stepped aside, and it was spun off into an independent organization. It now operates with an office in Chicago, and there's an independent board, and they're going to do the next Art House Convergence conference, from what I understand, in 2024. And so if you go to the Art House Convergence website, which is arthouseconvergence.org, you can get more information about the Art House Convergence.
Thank you, Russ, for everything you've contributed to the art house community. And that was fascinating to learn more about Ann Arbor's history with film.
And now a word from our friend Pops.
Now it's dark. I first saw the David Lynch Blue Velvet on a Friday night in Houston at a multiplex in the Galleria Mall. It was September 19th, 1986. I know this is true because that's when the internet tells me the film opened across the country, and I saw it on opening day. In the theater was myself and a family of five who probably couldn't get into a movie that was selling well. and David Bean, the lead singer of the Judies, Houston's best new wave band. You've heard their song Ghost in a Bikini in the Jonathan Demme movie Married to the Mob. My favorite song of theirs is All the Pretty Girls, although all of their music is great. You know, let's not argue, okay? The movie opens with a lush orchestral score, almost overwhelming the lush blue velvet curtain that the credits are projected over. Then the iconic Bobby Vinton hit, Blue Velvet, wafts over a montage of the most oversaturated shots of Lumberton, North Carolina, that was technically possible at the time without being true Technicolor. Blue skies, white picket fences, red roses. A guy watering his lawn. The lawn guy dropping to the ground from a stroke. The green, green grass getting closer and closer. We hear insects as the camera keeps pushing in until we see the chaotic insect world beneath the pretty grass. This is the beginning of the turning point in David Lynch's career, when he went from cult favorite director of Eraserhead to David Lynch, all in caps. Yes, he had directed the critically acclaimed The Elephant Man, and people were aware that his bastardized adaptation of Dune had opened and closed in a week. But Blue Velvet? Good God, have you seen it? I sure did. By the winter of 1986, everyone had at River Oaks Theater. Several times. And everyone we knew had. Over and over. That can't be healthy, right? This is a story about obsession and memory. It references a film that did play at the River Oaks Theater a few weeks after it opened around the country. More importantly, it reflects on, just a little, how life can imitate art, art can imitate life, and how a movie can become the answer to a question you didn't even know you had. That first screening I saw, I sat in the back of the theater on the right-hand side facing the screen. The family sat dead center. David Bean sat in the front row on the left-hand side. I remember that image very clearly. By the middle of the movie, the family got up and left. By the end, David Bean and I were laughing our asses off at the whole thing. When I got home, I tried explaining it to my roommates. I'm not sure if I loved or hated it, I told them, but I don't think I'll ever forget it. I just experienced art, real art, for the first time. I'd never seen Eraserhead, too weird. Or The Elephant Man, too much of a punchline to a lot of bad jokes mocking an incredibly tragic story I was too immature to get. I missed Dune. Even in those pre-internet days, everyone knew it was a dog and to avoid it. So nothing prepared me for the onslaught that was David Lynch discovers how genre can put his vision across to the masses. It was film noir and the Hardy Boys in a mixer with, well, David Lynch. It was the kind of thing a former Eagle Scout who got one too many avant-garde merit badges and sounded like Jimmy Stewart when he talked about the beauty of severed ears would make. And I wasn't alone with being haunted by this film. In the group of people who worked at River Oaks Theater at the time, everyone had gotten Lynch's disease put in them, as Isabella Rossellini's character Dorothy Valens says in the movie. Disease as dis-ease, the ecstatic anxiousness his work can inspire, along with the serene confidence of having seen something you know you've never seen before in an American cinema, unless you watched another David Lynch film. We all became kind of obsessed. We walked around the theater, quoting the movie to each other with little nervous giggles. On a tiny portable black and white TV in the box office, we watched Dennis Hopper, whose career was revived with his portrayal of the F-bomb dropping noir weirdo Frank Booth, drop an F-bomb, I think, during a Blue Velvet sketch when he guest hosted Saturday Night Live. And that December, somebody, I'm fairly sure not me, although it does sound like something I'd think up, got the bright idea to perform excerpts from the film on stage at the theater during our staff Christmas party. Now, parties at the theater, I'm not sure I will ever be allowed to go into too much detail of what happened there. This may be one of the only times I do, so listen up. The group of us who performed, I only remember the ones who played Isabella Rossellini's Dorothy Valens, Laura Dern's Sandy White, and Hopper's Frank Booth. That last one was me, I'm sure. I think. We had a box office person at the time who prefers to go by her alias she used back in Austin when she went to school there. It was Doll. Fawn Doll. She started working at the theater in November of 1980 in order to see the quasi-documentary about Britain's The Clash called Rude Boy. Fawn, when I talked to her the other day, is a veteran teacher in one of the school systems of the area. She was a teacher in 1986, and she played Dorothy, the broken chanteuse. She got the part because she had a blue bathrobe and brunette hair. The woman who played Sandy is now a teacher as well. At the time, she was about to be promoted to assistant manager and was taking really intense media studies classes at University of Houston, a number of which had to do with the great German filmmaker Rania Werner Fassbinder, which is funny to me because she's also one of the funniest, most open-hearted people I've ever known, a truly sunny person. Let's call her Sandy. And I played Frank because of my thorough theatrical training. And I can be really big and loud. You need to be to fill up a 500-seat space. After a few drinks, it wouldn't be a strain. And by drinks, I mean soda, of course. We had invited everybody on the staff, and they brought friends. The place was not filled up, but it feels right to say about 20 or 30 people. This would be around Christmas time, so it probably started around 11 or so at night. We had someone running the cassette of the film's soundtrack, Angelo Badalamenti's first work with the director he was to be associated with for most of his career, Roy Orbison pouring his Texas operatic tenor over In Dreams, Bobby Vinton's Blue Velvet, of course. And then we did the movie. Really scenes, I guess. Not the whole thing. Sandy being very sweet. Dorothy staggering around. I think we only did the joyride scene with her. And I, roaring on stage, screaming F-bombs every other word, I was happy I got to say, "Pabst Blue Ribbon! The audience was whelmed. We probably screened the film too. We had a lot of screenings at those parties where we drank a lot of soda. Now here's the kicker to all of this. At the time of this recording, I am the only one who remembers any of this. Not Fawn, not Sandy. No one else who would have been around then that I've talked to, none of them remembered any of it happening. I get a lot of, "Oh, that sounds like something we'd do." One guy said, "Now that you mention it, maybe, yeah." Mostly they remember other parties. I had a 25th birthday party I may talk about sometime. As it seems, everyone remembers that one much, much better. In their defense, all of this happened almost 40 years ago. And as you can probably tell, I only remember, well, vague images fading in and out of each other like a fever dream that maybe never happened. It won't surprise you to know I remember a lot of my life according to the movies I saw at the time. It feels like it fits the way memory works for people in general. Images, some words, all of which fade into each other like a surreal dreamscape that triggers emotions, not facts. It all sort of runs together in a kind of mood genre filled with feelings that indicate something happened that made you sad or happy, anxious, calm. Lynch is a master of that kind of filmmaking. And while my memory of my time at the Art House isn't a dark one, River Oaks Theater takes up a lot of my heart. It's something I've realized talking and laughing with the people who were there when I was there. The dream quality that the candy-colored clown they call the Sandman can bring each night, that quality is something Lynch really nails. And it feels like a great film can be in dialogue with your memory in a very, well, David Lynch fashion. Whether it is a dark but silly drunken reenactment with friends at a party of a movie you just can't get out of your head, or the bright saturated color of day when the robins come filled with light and eating gross bugs.
And now a conversation with Jamie Townsend, the executive director of the Houston Cinema Arts Society.
Hi, Rachel. Good to be here.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks so much for coming here. So the Houston Cinema Arts Society is partnering with the Southwest Alternate Media Project and the International Entertainment Partnership to put together a new conference. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. This is the first annual Houston Media Conference. So what we're really trying to do with this conference is to bring together all of the media professionals and media organizations that exist in Houston so that we can share knowledge and share resources and create an opportunity for education and networking for all of the local talent and regional talent that exists in Texas. It's felt to us like for too long, the problem with making movies or making media here in Houston is that we have all these great resources, but they're somewhat siloed. So a way of creating a stronger and more cohesive film culture is to bring them all under one roof and create an opportunity for people to go in and learn all kinds of important things about funding film and about legal matters behind film and about actually creating and writing film, while they're also being exposed to some of the vendors that exist in Houston and some of the other resources that people can take advantage of if they want to create media here.
That's wonderful. I think that's definitely a need that Houston has.
I agree.
To connect individuals because we are so siloed, we are so spread out. So can you tell me a little bit about what people can expect from the conference?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. We're going to have sort of two parts. It's going to be at Post, which is a really cool location if you haven't been to Post.
We love it. The old Post office.
Really, really neat space. And there's a great international food court and all kinds of other things to keep you busy while you're there. So check out Post. It's great. And they've been a really cool partner for us. We were, I think, the first arts organization to do anything there. We were at their grand opening. We showed a movie on the roof, which is super cool. There's going to be one space that's going to be kind of an expo floor where all of the vendors, all of the people who have lighting and sound equipment and studio spaces and other resources that local and regional filmmakers can avail themselves of, people can kind of walk around and check that out. I believe that part you can attend for free, but we ask that you please go to our website and sign up because it still helps with priority stuff. The other part of it is more of a conference. So there will be a lot of local media professionals who will come in and talk about how do you go about making movies here in Houston and all of the different aspects of that. So it's really just kind of an open forum for media professionals and a way for people to meet each other. We're especially excited about the Friday night event on the first night of the conference, a speed networking event. It'll be really, really fun for people to meet each other.
Oh, great. Yeah, it's always daunting to try and put yourself out there and you're getting into a new industry and trying to make connections. So a speed networking is a great way to facilitate that.
Yeah, certainly. I talked to a young man just yesterday who's a cinematographer and he's really trying to get started. He just moved back to Houston. He grew up here and he's looking for that kind of access and that kind of way in. This was kind of my problem. I grew up in Houston and I left to go work in Hollywood. And when I came back, I couldn't find a film community. I couldn't find people to work with. And I ended up not getting to work in film in Houston because even though it existed in small pieces across town, there was no real cohesion. So I didn't really know where to go to meet people and share ideas with and get resources from. So obviously, I'm just trying to correct the mistakes of my own life from 20 years ago for other people.
That's what we do.
That's what we do. Mm-hmm. We try and make it a little bit better. Part of the role of Houston Cinema Arts Society is to create a better film culture here in Houston. And one of the ways that we do that is through our annual film festival in November. Please check that out, cinemahtx.org. Pay attention for more details. That's going to be really exciting this year. But another way that we do that is through a lot of really impactful screenings that are of interest to different groups within the community. The third way that we do that, and what the Houston Media Conference is meant to do, is to create those networking and education opportunities so that the film community in Houston can experience that cohesion and can figure out how do we get started? It's definitely possible. I mean, Houston's a great place for the next movies, the next stories to really come from, just because it is the most diverse city in the United States. We talk about this often, that New York and Los Angeles, people think of those places as where you go to learn about movies and where you go to make movies. They all sort of understand that there is a diversity, equity, and inclusion problem. They all know that that's something that they want to resolve. But because they're so deeply entrenched in their institutions, it becomes very difficult for people to break into that. So creating another space where a film industry can grow that's not already entrenched in those institutions is great. And doing it in the most diverse city in the United States and in a city where, you know, we really do believe that anything is possible. We really have this broad support for all the arts. Maybe not as much for film yet, but we're working on that. It feels like the next great stories should come from a city like Houston that has that diversity and has that energy and it has that sort of focus on the future. So we're really excited about just playing whatever part we can and helping to make that film culture more successful here.
Oh, definitely. I think Houston has so much potential and we can definitely have a thriving industry here. We just have to come together and support each other and connect.
Exactly. And that's the point of the Houston Media Conference. So if you care about film in Houston, if you care about making it more possible, this is the first annual Houston Media Conference. We expect to continue this year after year. And we just hope that it grows and attracts more people, attracts more vendors, more sponsors, and really takes off and becomes something that the city pays attention to.
Which is great. I think this is something that we really need to bring everybody together and spread knowledge. Can you talk about some more highlights from the program?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I already mentioned the speed networking event on the first night of the conference, which is very exciting. There will be a lot of conference opportunities, keynote speakers talking about building success as an indie filmmaker. That's going to be exciting. Our good friend Jenny Waldo, who produced movies here, is talking about funding your indie film. I'm excited about that one too. There's going to be classes on screenwriting. There's going to be a panel conversation on the future of indie film. There's going to be a panel on the future of Houston's media industry. There's going to be another class on the legal issues behind creating a film and how you sort of navigate that. And we keep adding to it. We keep adding more classes. We keep adding more vendors. So it continues to grow. So
amazing.
I'm excited about it. I don't know. What about you, Rachel? What are you most excited about? What did I leave off?
There's some really amazing things. Some highlights from the program include the Film Festival Doctor's Guide to Navigating the Festival Circuit, which I think more people in our community should be taking advantage of film festivals and getting their work out there, as well as the Ask the Legal Expert. I think having access to an entertainment lawyer, someone who you can go to for advice, is going to be very beneficial to a lot of people.
Oh yeah, that would have saved a lot of people problems that I know in my life. Yeah.
Yes. And the keynote speaker, Dominique Telson, is incredible. She's a multi-Emmy nominated producer and executive producer of both feature films and television series.
Yeah, we're very excited to have her and very lucky to have her be a part of it. Again, back to what you said about festivals, we are, as Houston Cinema Arts Society, we're trying to be a showcase for local talent, for regional talent, so that we're showing what the next Texas filmmakers can do, what they can accomplish. So if you haven't been paying attention to what Texas film festivals are doing, please do. And cinemahtx.org is a great place to check us out at the Houston Cinema Arts Festival every year in November, a big part of what we do.
And where can people learn more about the conference?
Yeah, you can always link to it from our website, which is cinemahtx.org, or the conference website is hmc23.eventive.org. You can go ahead and get your passes on there. You can learn more about the schedule on there and get a whole lot more information about what we're doing.
Amazing. We're looking forward to it. That is August 25th through the 27th at Post HTX.
Can't wait. We'll see you there.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
On Thursday, September 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Match Houston, the Real Abilities Film Festival is having a benefit concert. David Harris presents An Evening of Original Jazz. For tickets, go to matchhouston.org. This September at the Museum of Fine Arts is the upcoming film series, Thelma Ritter, Hollywood's Favorite New Yorker, including films like All About Eve, Rear Window, and Pick Up on South Street. For tickets and more information, go to mfah.org. This September, Friends of River Oaks is screening Metropolis with a live score and short films inspired by the classic. And coming soon, John Waters' Trashathon, screening at Numbers in partnership with the Performing Arts Houston. And John Waters is going to be there live to perform. Utopia's Shiva Baby returns to Houston August 22nd at Match. For tickets, go to cinemahtx.org.
Friends on Film was created by Justice Tirapelli Jamail, Rachel Valentine Acosta, Maureen McNamara, and Mario Rodriguez. Friends on Film's theme was composed for the podcast by Jeff Walton. This episode was scored by artist and musician Hesher. You can buy and stream his music at www.hescher.bandcamp.com.
Special thanks to White Oak Music Hall, which is proud to support fellow arts organization Friends of River Oaks Theater in its mission to preserve art, cinema, and culture in Houston.
Friends on Film is funded in part by the City of Houston through Houston Arts Alliance.
Dionysus Imports is a proud sponsor of this episode and the distributor of Kyle MacLachlan's wine label, Pursued by Bear, widely available in wine bars and fine dining establishments. At Plains Capital Bank, relationships come first. Customers value their Texas roots, strength, stability, and straightforward approach. Plains Capital Bank's true legacy is the positive effect they have on their greater community, and this sponsorship is an example of how they give back. To learn more, visit plainscapital.com. Thanks to Patrick Brooks, Rhonda Cook, Ian Druk, Kayleen McNamara, Grace Posey, Pedro Salazar, Taylor Smith, Johnny So, Grant Turley, Stephen Wells, Heather Green Warner, and Kyle Vaughn, and all of today's guests. If you'd like to become a sponsor or have any questions, please email podcast@friendsriveroakstheater.org.
Thanks again for tuning in.
We'll see you at the movies.